Or what? Does it make your day? It makes mine, and it will make the wolf's too.
Chapter 106.
Pasha Sorokin wasn't the wolf. Was that possible? There was no way to know for sure. Over the next 48 hours, it was confirmed that the men we had captured in Florida were Pasha Sorokin and Ruslan Fedorov. They were Red Mafia, but both claimed never to have met the real wolf. They said they had played the parts they were given, stand-in roles, according to them. Now they were willing to make the best deals they could. There was no way for us to know for sure what was going on, but the deal-making went on for 2 days. The Bureau liked to make deals. I didn't. Contacts were made inside the Mafia. More doubts were raised about Pasha Sorokin's being the wolf. Finally, the CIA operatives who'd gotten the wolf out of Russia were found and brought to Pasha's cell. They said he wasn't the man they'd helped to get out of the Soviet Union. Then it was Sorokin who gave us a name we wanted. One that blew my mind completely, blew everybody's mind. It was part of his deal. He gave us Sphinx. The next morning, four teams of FBI agents waited outside Sphinx's house until he left for work. We had agreed not to take him inside the house. I wouldn't let it go down that way. I just couldn't do it. We all felt that Lizzie Connolly and her daughters had been through more than enough pain already. They didn't need to see Brendan Connolly, Sphinx, arrested at the family house in Buckhead. They didn't need to find out the awful truth about him like that. I sat in a dark blue sedan parked two blocks up the street, but with a view of the large Georgian-style house. I was feeling numb. I remembered the first time I'd been there. I recalled my talk with the girls, and then with Brendan Connolly in his den. His grief had seemed heartfelt, as genuine as his young daughter's. Of course, no one had suspected he had betrayed his wife, sold her to another man. Pasha Sorokin had met Elizabeth at a party in the Connolly house. He'd wanted her. Brendan Connolly didn't. The judge had been having affairs for years. Elizabeth reminded Sorokin of the model Claudia Schiffer, who had appeared on billboards all over Moscow during his gangster days. So the horrifying trade was made. A husband had sold his own wife into captivity. He'd gotten rid of her in the worst way imaginable. How could he have hated Elizabeth so much? And how could she have loved him? Ned Mahoney was in the car with me, waiting for action. The takedown of Sphinx. If we couldn't have the wolf yet, he was our second choice, the consolation prize. I wonder if Elizabeth knew about her husband's secret life, Mahoney muttered. Maybe she suspected something. They didn't sleep together regularly. When I visited the house, Connolly showed me the den. There was a bed in there, unmade. Think he'll go to work today? Mahoney asked. He was calmly munching an apple. A very cool head to work with. He knows we took down Sorokin and Fedorov. I figure he'll be cautious. He'll probably play it straight. Hard to tell. Maybe we should take him at the house, you think? He bit into his apple again. Alex? I shook my head. I can't do it, Ned. Not to his family. Okay. Just asking, buddy. We waited. A little past nine, Brendan Connolly finally came out the front door of the house. He walked to a silver Porsche Boxster parked in the circular driveway. He had on a blue suit, carried a black gym bag. He was whistling. Scumbag, Mahoney whispered. Then he spoke into his two-way. This is Alpha One. We have Sphinx leaving the house. He's getting into a Porsche. Prepare to converge. Vehicle license is V6T81K. We heard back immediately. This is Braves One. We have Sphinx in full sight, too. We've got him covered. He's ours. Then, Braves Three in place at second intersect. We're waiting on him. Should be about 10 to 15 seconds. He's heading down the street, making a right. I spoke very calmly to Mahoney. I want to take him down, Ned. He looked straight ahead through the windshield. Didn't answer me, but he didn't say no. I watched the Porsche proceed at a normal speed to the next cross street. The Boxster eased into the turn. And then Brendan Connolly ran. Oh, boy, said Mahoney, and tossed away his apple. Chapter 107. A message came over the shortwave. Suspect is going southeast. He must have seen us. I gunned our car in the direction the Porsche had disappeared. I managed to get the sedan up to 65 on the narrow, winding street lined with gated McMansions. I still couldn't see the silver Porsche up ahead. I'm heading east, I said into the two-way. I'll take a chance he's trying to get to the highway. I didn't know what else to do. I passed several cars coming the other way on the quiet street. A couple of drivers sat on their horns. That's what I would have done, too. I was going 75 miles an hour in a residential area. I see him, Mahoney yelled. I stepped down hard on the gas. I was finally making up some ground. I spotted a blue sedan approaching the Porsche from the east. It was Braves, too. We had Brendan Connolly from two sides. Now the question was whether or not he'd give up. Suddenly, the Porsche shot right off the road and into a thicket of bushes that rose higher than the car's roof. The Porsche tilted forward, then disappeared down a steep slope. I didn't slow down until the last second. Then I braked hard and went into a controlled shudder and spin. Jesus Christ! Mahoney shouted from the passenger seat. Thought you were HRT, I said. Mahoney laughed. All right then, partner. Let's go get the bad guy. I steered the sedan through the bushes and found myself on a steep hill dotted with large rocks and trees. When the first branches cleared, I still had limited vision because of all the other trees. Then I saw the Porsche smack into a mid-sized oak and carom to one side. The car slid sideways another 50 feet before it finally stopped. Sphinx was down. Let's go get the bad guy. Chapter 108 Mahoney and I wanted Sphinx, and it was personal with me, maybe with both of us. I let our sedan roll another 50 or 60 yards, then I braked and the car stopped. Mahoney and I jumped out. We almost slid down the steep hill, which was slippery with mud. Crazy son of a bitch, Ned Mahoney shouted as we stumbled ahead. What choice did he have? He had to run. I mean you. You're crazy. What a ride. We saw Brendan Connolly lurch out of the damaged Porsche. He held a handgun aimed our way. Connolly fired off two quick shots. He wasn't good with a gun, but he was shooting real bullets. Son of a bitch! Mahoney fired a shot and hit the Porsche, just to show Connolly that we could shoot him if we wanted to. Put the gun down, Mahoney shouted. Put the gun down! Brendan Connolly started to run down the hill, but he was stumbling a lot. Mahoney and I kept gaining on him until we were only 30 yards or so behind. Let me, I said. Brendan Connolly looked back over his shoulder just then. I could tell he was tired, scared, or both. His legs and arms were pumping in a disjointed rhythm. He might work out in some gym, but he wasn't ready for this. Get back! I'll shoot! He shouted. Almost right into my face. I hit him, and it was like a speeding tractor trailer back-ending a barely moving compact. Connolly went down, rolling crazily. I stayed upright, didn't even lose my balance. This was the good part. It almost made up for some of our misses and failures. Connolly's ignominious roll finally stopped after 20 feet, but then he made his biggest mistake. He got back up. I was on him in a second. I was all over Sphinx, and it was where I wanted to be. Mano a mano with this bastard. He had sold his own wife, the mother of his children. I threw a hard right-handed shot into the bridge of Connolly's nose. The perfect shot, or close to it. Probably broke it from the crunch I heard. He went down on one knee, but he got up again. Former college jock. Former tough guy. Current asshole. His nose was hanging to one side. Good deal. I threw an uppercut into the pit of Connolly's stomach and liked the feeling so much I threw another. I crunched another right into his gut, which was softening to the touch. Then a quick hard hook to his cheek. I was getting stronger. I jabbed his broken nose and Connolly moaned. I jabbed again. I looped a roundhouse at his chin, connected. Bullseye. Brendan Connolly's blue eyes rolled back into his forehead. The lights went out and he dropped into the mud and stayed there, where he belonged. I heard a voice behind me. "That how it's done in D.C.?" Mahoney asked from a few yards up the hill. I looked up at him. "That's how it's done, Natty Bumpo. Hope you took notes."
Chapter 109.
The next couple of weeks were quiet. Disturbingly. Maddeningly so. I found out I was being assigned to headquarters in Washington as Deputy Director of Investigations under Director Burns. A big fat plum, I was told by everybody. It sounded like a desk job to me, and I didn't want that. I wanted the wolf. I wanted the street. I wanted action. I hadn't come over to the bureau to be a desk jockey in the Hoover Building. I was given a week off, and Nana, the kids, and I went everywhere together. There was a lot of tension in the house, though. We were waiting to hear what Christine Johnson was going to do. Every time I looked at Alex, my heart ached. Every time I held him in my arms or tucked him into bed at the end of the day, I thought about his leaving the house for good. I couldn't let that happen, but my lawyer had advised me it could. The director needed to see me in his office one morning during my week off. It wasn't too much of a problem. I stopped in after I had dropped the kids off at school. Tony Woods, Burns' assistant, seemed particularly glad to see me. "You're something of a hero for the moment. Enjoy it," he said, sounding as always like an Ivy League professor. "Won't last long." "Always the optimist, Tony," I said. "That's my job description, young man." I wondered how much Ron Burns shared with his assistant, and also what the director had in mind this morning. I wanted to ask Tony about this plum job I was slated for, but I didn't. I figured he wouldn't tell me anyway. Coffee and sweet rolls were waiting in Burns' office, but the director wasn't there. It was a little past 8. I wondered if he'd even gotten to work yet. It was hard to imagine that Ron Burns had a life outside the office, though I knew he had a wife and 4 children and lived out in Virginia, about an hour from D.C. Burns finally appeared at the door in a blue dress shirt and tie with his shirt sleeves rolled up, so now I knew he'd had at least one meeting before this one. Actually, I hoped this meeting wasn't about another case he wanted me to dive into, unless it involved the wolf. Burns grinned when he saw me sitting there. He read my look instantly. "Actually, I have a couple of nasty cases for you to work on. But that isn't why I wanted to see you, Alex. Have some coffee. Relax. You're on vacation, right?" He walked into the room and sat down across from me. "I want to hear how it's going so far. You miss being a homicide detective? Still want to stay in the bureau? You can leave if you want to. The Washington PD wants you back. Badly. That's good to hear that I'm wanted. As for the Bureau, what can I say? The resources are amazing. Lots of good people here. Great people. I hope you know that." "I do. I'm a fan of our personnel. Most of them, anyway." "And on the dark side?" he asked. "Problem areas? Things to work on?" "I want to hear what you think. I need to hear it. Tell me the truth as you see it." "Bureaucracy. It's a way of life. It's almost the FBI's culture. And fear. It's mostly political in nature, and it inhibits agents' imaginations. Did I mention bureaucracy? It's bad, awful, crippling. Just listen to your agents." "I'm listening," Burns said. Go on. The agents aren't allowed to be nearly as good as they can be. Of course, that's a complaint with most jobs, isn't it? Even your old job with the Washington PD? Not as much as here. That's because I sidestepped a lot of red tape and other bullshit that got in the way. Good. Keep sidestepping the bullshit, Alex, Burns said. Even if it's mine. I smiled. Is that an order? Burns nodded soberly. I felt that he had something else on his mind. I had a difficult meeting before you got here. Gordon Nooney is leaving the Bureau. I shook my head. I hope I didn't have anything to do with that. I don't know Nooney well enough to judge him. Seriously, I don't. Sorry, but you did have something to do with it. But it was my decision. The buck passes through here at 100 miles an hour, and I like it that way. I do know Nooney well enough to judge him. Nooney was the leak to the Washington Post. That son of a bitch has been doing it for years. Alex, I thought about putting you in Nooney's job. I was shocked to hear it. I've never trained people. I didn't finish orientation myself. But you could train our people. I wasn't sure about that. Maybe I could struggle through. But I like the streets. It's in my blood. I've learned to accept that about myself. I know. I get it, Alex. I want you to work right here in the Hoover Building, though. We're going to change things. We're going to win more than we lose. Work the big cases with Stacy Pollack here at headquarters. She's one of the best. Tough. Smart. She could run this place someday. I can work with Stacy, I said, and left it at that. Ron Burns put out his hand, and I took it. This is going to be good. Exciting stuff, he said. Which reminds me of a promise I made. There's a spot here for Detective John Sampson and any D.C. street cop you like. Anybody who wants to win. We're going to win, Alex. I shook Ron Burns' hand on it. The thing is, I wanted to win, too.
Chapter 110.
On Monday morning, I was in my new office on the 5th floor at headquarters in D.C. Tony Woods had given me a walking tour earlier that morning, and I was struck by strange, funny details that I couldn't get out of my head. Like, the office doors were metal all through the building, except on the executive floor, where they were wooden. The odd thing, though, the wooden doors looked exactly like the metal ones. Welcome to the FBI. Anyway, I had a lot of reading to do, and I hoped I'd get used to being in an 11-by-15-foot office, which was kind of bare. The furniture looked as if it were on loan from the government accounting office. There was a desk and chair, a file cabinet with a large dial lock, and a coat tree that held my black Kevlar vest and blue nylon raid jacket. The office looked down on Pennsylvania Avenue, which was something of a perk. Just past 2 that afternoon, I got a phone call. Actually, the first incoming call to my new office. It was Tony Woods. All settled in? He asked. Anything you need? I'm getting there, Tony. I'll be fine. Thanks for asking. Good. Alex, you're going out of town in about an hour. There's a lead on the Wolf in Brooklyn. Stacy Pollack will be going with you, so it's a big deal. You fly out of Quantico at 1500. This thing isn't over. I called home, then I gathered some paperwork on the Wolf, grabbed the overnight bag I'd been told to keep in my office, and headed to the parking garage. Stacy Pollack came down a few minutes later. She drove, and it took us less than an hour to get to the small private airfield at Quantico. On the way, she told me about the lead in Brooklyn. Supposedly, the real Wolf had been spotted at Brighton Beach. At least we weren't giving up on him. One of the black bells was saddled up and waiting for us. Stacy and I got out of the sedan and walked side by side toward the helicopter. The skies were bright blue and streaming with clouds that appeared to be shredding in the distance. Nice day for a train wreck, Stacy said, and grinned. A shot rang out from the woods directly behind us. I had thrown back my head, laughing at Stacy's little joke. I saw her get hit and blood spatter. I went down and covered her body. Agents ran onto the tarmac. One of them fired in the direction of the sniper shot. Two came sprinting toward us. The others ran towards the woods in the direction of the shot. I lay on Stacy, trying to protect her, hoping she wasn't dead, and wondering if maybe the bullet had been meant for me. "You'll never catch the wolf," Pasha Sorokin had said in Florida. "He will catch you." Now the warning had come true. The briefing that night at the Hoover Building was the most emotional I had seen at the Bureau so far. Stacy Pollack was alive, but she was in critical condition at Walter Reed. Most of the agents respected Stacy Pollack tremendously, and they couldn't believe she'd been targeted. I still wondered if the bullet had been meant for her. She and I had been headed to New York to see about the wolf. He was the chief suspect in the shooting. But did he have help? Was there someone inside the Bureau? "The other bad news," Ron Burns told the group that night, "is that our lead in Brighton Beach turns out to be bogus. The wolf isn't in New York, and apparently he wasn't there recently. The questions that we have to answer are, did he know we were going after him? If he knew, how did he know? Did one of us tell him? I promise that we will spare nothing to get the answers to those questions." After the meeting, I was one of the agents invited to a smaller briefing held in the director's conference room. The mood continued to be somber, serious, and angry. Burns took the floor again, and he seemed more upset by the Stacy Pollack shooting than anyone else. "When I said that we were going to bring that Russian bastard down, I wasn't using hyperbole for effect. I'm establishing a BAM team to go after him. Sorokin said that the wolf would come after us, and he did. Now we're going to go after him, with everything we have, all our resources." Heads around the room nodded their approval. I'd heard of the existence of BAM teams in the FBI, but hadn't known if they were real or not. I knew what the acronym stood for. By any means. It was what we needed to hear right now. It was what I needed to hear. BAM.
Chapter 111.
Everything felt like it was going much too fast, like it was spinning out of control. Maybe that was right. The case was out of our control. The wolf was running it. I got a phone call at home two nights later. It was 3:15 in the morning.
"This had better be good."
"It isn't. All hell's broken loose, Alex. It's a war." The caller was Tony Woods, and he sounded groggy. I massaged my forehead as I spoke. "What war? Tell me what happened." "We got word from Texas a few minutes ago. Lawrence Lipton is dead. Murdered. They got to him in his cell." I was starting to wake up in a hurry. "How? He was in our custody, wasn't he?" "Two agents were killed with Lipton." "He predicted it, didn't he?" I nodded. Then I said, "Yeah." "Alex, they got to the Lipton family, too. They're all dead. HRT is on the way to your house, also the directors, even Mahoney's. Anybody who worked on the case is considered vulnerable and at risk." That got me up out of bed. I took my Glock out of the locked cabinet beside my bed. "I'll be waiting for HRT," I told Woods. Then I hurried downstairs with my gun in hand. Was the wolf already here? I wondered. The war came to our house a few minutes later, and even though it was HRT, it couldn't have been much scarier. Nana Mama was up, and she greeted the heavily armed FBI agents with angry looks, but also offers of coffee. Then she and I went to wake the children as gently as we could.
"This isn't right, Alex. Not in our home," Nana Mama whispered as we went upstairs to get Janny and Damon. "The line has to be drawn somewhere, doesn't it? This is bad."
"I know it is. It's gotten out of control. Everything has. The world is that way now."
"So what are you going to do about it? What are you planning to do?" Right now, wake the kids. Hug them, kiss them. Get them out of this house for a while.
Are you listening to yourself?
Nana asked as we arrived at the doorway to Damon's bedroom. He was already sitting up in bed.
Dad, he said.
Ned Mahoney came up behind me. Alex, can I have a second?
What was he doing here?
What else had happened?
I'll wake them, get them dressed, Nana said. Talk to your friend.
I stayed behind with Mahoney.
What is it, Ned? Can't it wait for a couple of minutes? Jesus.
The bastards hit Burns's house. Everybody's all right. We got there in time. I stared into Mahoney's eyes.
Your family?
They're out of the house. They're safe for now. We've got to find him and burn him. I nodded. Let me get my kids up. 20 minutes later, my family was escorted outside to a waiting van. They climbed inside like frightened refugees in a war zone. That's what the world was becoming, wasn't it? Every city and town was a potential battlefield. No place was safe. Just before I climbed into the van, I spotted a photographer posted across the street from our house on Fifth Street. It looked like he was photographing the evacuation of our house.
Why was that?
I'm not sure how I knew who he was, but somehow I did. He's not from any newspaper, I thought. I felt myself filling with rage and disgust. He works for Christine's lawyers.
Chapter 112.
Chaos. The next day, and for 2 days after that, I found myself in Huntsville, Texas, the site of the federal prison where Lawrence Lipton had been murdered while he was in the custody of the Federal Bureau. No one there had any explanation for how Lipton and two agents had been killed. It had happened during the night, in his cell. Actually, the small suite where he was kept under guard. None of the video cameras had a record of visitors. None of the interviews or interrogations had turned up a suspect. Lipton had had most of the bones in his body broken. Zemoshit, the Red Mafia trademark. The same method had been used on an Italian mafia figure named Agostino Palumbo this past summer. According to stories, Palumbo's killer had been a Russian mobster, possibly the Wolf. The murder had taken place at the Supermax prison in Florence, Colorado. The following morning, I arrived in Colorado. I was there to visit a killer named Kyle Craig, who had once been an FBI agent and also a friend of mine. Kyle was responsible for dozens of murders. He was one of the worst psychopathic killers in history. I had captured him. My friend. We met in an interview room on death row in the isolation unit. Kyle looked surprisingly fit. When I'd last seen him, he had been gaunt and very pale, with deep dark hollows under his eyes. He appeared to have put on at least 30 pounds, all of it muscle. I wondered why. What had given Kyle hope? Whatever it was scared me a little.
All roads lead to Florence?
He quipped, and grinned as I entered the interview room.
Some associates of yours from the Bureau were here just yesterday, or was it the day before? You know, the last time we met, Alex, you said you didn't care what I think. That hurt.
I corrected him, which I knew would annoy Kyle. Not exactly what I said. You accused me of being condescending and told me that you didn't like it. I said, who cares what you like anymore? I do care about what you think. That's why I'm here. Kyle laughed again, and the braying sound he made, the baring of his teeth, chilled me.
You always were my favorite.
You were expecting me?
Hard to say. Not really. Maybe at some time in the future.
You look like you have big plans. You're all buffed.
What plans could I possibly have?
The usual. Grand delusions, homicidal fantasies, rape, the slaughter of innocents.
I do hate it when you play psychologist, Alex. You didn't make it in that world for a good reason.
I shrugged. I know that, Kyle. None of my patients in Southeast had money to pay me. I needed to start a practice in Georgetown. Maybe I will someday. He laughed again.
Talk about delusions. So why are you here? No, I'll tell you why. There's been a terrible miscarriage of justice, and I'm being released. You're the messenger of glad tidings.
The only miscarriage is that you haven't been executed, Kyle. Kyle's eyes sparkled. I was one of his favorites.
All right. Now that you've charmed me, what is it that you want?
You know what I want, Kyle, I said. You know exactly why I'm here. He clapped his hands loudly.
Ah, Zamuchit, the mad Russian.
For the next half an hour, I told Kyle everything I knew about the wolf. Well, nearly everything. Then I gave him the kicker. He met with you on the night he came here to kill little Gus Palumbo. Did you set up the kill for him? Somebody did. Kyle leaned back and seemed to be considering his options, but I knew he'd already decided what he meant to do. He was always a step or two ahead. Finally, he leaned forward and beckoned me closer. I wasn't afraid of Kyle, at least not physically, not even with his extra pounds of muscle. I almost hoped he'd make a move.
I do this out of love and respect for you. I did meet with a Russian last summer. Ruthless chap, no conscience. I liked him. We played chess. I know who he is, my friend. I might be able to help you.
Chapter 113.
It took me another day at Florence, but I finally negotiated a name out of Kyle. Now, could we believe him? The name was checked and rechecked in Washington, and the Bureau was becoming confident that he had given us the Red Mafia leader. I had doubts, because it came from Kyle. But we had no other leads. Maybe Kyle was trying to blow me up or embarrass the Bureau. Or maybe he wanted to demonstrate how smart he was, how well-connected, how superior to us all. The name, the person's position, made the arrest controversial and risky. If we went after this man and we were wrong, the embarrassment would stick to the Bureau. So we waited for nearly a week. We checked all our information again and did several interviews in the field. The suspect was put under surveillance. When we had completed the due diligence, I met with Ron Burns and the director of the CIA in Burns' office. Ron got to the point. We believe he's the wolf, Alex. Craig is probably telling the truth. Thomas Weir from the CIA nodded my way. We've been watching this suspect in New York for some time. We thought he'd been KGB back in Russia, but there wasn't conclusive evidence. We never suspected Red Mafia, never the wolf. Not this man. Not given his position with the Russian government. Weir's look was intense. We increased the levels of audio surveillance to include the apartment where the suspect lives in Manhattan. He's making arrangements to go after Director Burns again. Burns looked at me. He doesn't forgive and forget, Alex. Neither do I. Is that it? We go to New York and arrest him? Burns and Weir nodded solemnly. This should be the end of it, said Burns. Go and take down the wolf. Bring me his head.
Chapter 114.
This should be the end of it. From Director Burns's mouth to God's ear. The Century is a famous Art Deco apartment building on Central Park West, north of Columbus Circle in New York City. For decades, it has been a residence of choice for well-to-do actors, artists, and business people, but especially those who are humble enough to share space with working-class families who've passed down their apartments for decades. We arrived at the building around 4 in the morning. HRT immediately took over the 3 main entrances on Central Park, 62nd, and 63rd Streets. This was the largest bust I had been a part of, definitely the most complicated.
The New York City Police, FBI, CIA, and Secret Service were all involved in the operation. We were about to take down an important Russian, the head of the trade delegation to New York, a businessman himself, supposedly above suspicion. The repercussions would be severe if we were wrong. But how could we be wrong? Not this time. I was at the Sentry along with my partner for the past week or so. Ned Mahoney was hardworking, honest, and tough in the clutch. The head of HRT had been to my house and even passed Nana's inspection, mostly because he'd grown up on the streets of D.C. Ned and I and a dozen others were climbing the stairs to two penthouse floors, since the suspect's apartment was on 21 and 22. He was powerful and wealthy. He had a good reputation with Wall Street and the banks. So was he the Wolf? If so, why hadn't his name ever come up before? Because the Wolf was so good? So careful? "Be glad when this is over with," Mahoney said, without a huff or puff as he mounted the stairs. "How did it get out of hand like this?" I asked. "There are too many people here."
"Always too much politics. Better get used to it. World we live in. Too many suits, not enough workers."
We finally reached 21. Ned and I and four other agents stopped there. The rest of the team continued to 22. We waited for them to get into position. This was it. I hoped this was it. Was the real Wolf on one of these two floors? I heard an urgent voice in my earpiece. "Suspect coming out of a window. Man in his underwear jumped from the tower." "Jesus Christ, he's down on the landing between the towers. He's on the roof, running." Mahoney and I understood what had happened. We rushed down to the 20th floor. The Sentry had two towers that rose up from 20. A large expanse of roof connected them. We burst out onto the roof and immediately saw a barefoot man in his underwear. He was burly, balding, bearded. He turned and fired at us with a pistol. The Wolf? Balding? Burly? Could this be him? He hit Mahoney. He hit me. We went down hard. Chest shots. Hurt like hell. Took my breath away. Fortunately, we were wearing Kevlar vests. The man in his underwear wasn't. Mahoney's return fire took out a kneecap. My first shot struck his thick stomach. He went down, spurting blood and howling. We ran to the side of Andrei Prokopev. Mahoney kicked away his gun. "You're under arrest," Ned yelled into the face of the wounded Russian. "We know who you are." A helicopter appeared between the Sentry's towers. A woman was screaming from one of the windows several stories above us. Now the helicopter was landing. What the hell was this? A man came out of a window in the tower and dropped to the roof. Then another man. Professional gunmen, it looked like. Bodyguards. They were quick on the draw and began shooting the instant they hit the roof. HRT returned fire. Several shots were exchanged. Both gunmen were hit and went down. Neither got up again. HRT was that good. The helicopter was setting down on the roof. It wasn't media or police. It was there to get the Wolf and whisk him away, wasn't it? There were shots from the helicopter. Mahoney and I fired into the cockpit. There was another rapid exchange of gunfire. Then the shooting from the helicopter stopped. For several seconds, the only sound on the roof was the loud, eerie whirr of the helicopter's rotor blades. "Clear!" one of our agents finally yelled. "They're down in the copter!" "You're under arrest," Mahoney screamed at the Russian in his underwear. "You're the Wolf. You attacked the director's house, his family." I had something else in mind, another kind of message. I leaned in close and said, "Kyle Craig did this to you. I wanted him to know and maybe pay Kyle back someday. Maybe with Zamoshit."
Chapter 115.
I hope to God it was over now. We all did. Ned Mahoney flew back to Quantico that morning, but I spent the rest of the day at FBI headquarters in Lower Manhattan. The Russian government had filed protests everywhere they could, but Andrei Prokopev was still in custody, and State Department people were all over the FBI offices. Even a few Wall Street firms had questioned the arrest. So far, I hadn't been allowed to talk to the Russian again. He was scheduled for surgery, but his life wasn't in danger. He was being grilled by someone, just not by me. Burns finally reached me at around 4 o'clock in the office I was using at FBI New York. "Alex, I want you to head back to Washington," he said. "Flight arrangements have been made. We'll be waiting for you here." That was all he told me. Burns signed off, so I didn't get the chance to ask any questions. It was obvious that he didn't want me to. Around 7:30, I arrived at the Hoover Building and was told to go to the PSIOC conference area on 5. They were waiting for me there. Not exactly waiting, since a shirt-sleeves meeting was already in progress. Ron Burns was at the table, which wasn't a good sign. Everybody looked tense and exhausted. "Let me bring Alex up to date," Burns said when I entered the room. "Have a rest. Kick back. There's been a new wrinkle. None of us are very happy about it. You won't be either." I shook my head and felt a little sick as I sat down. I didn't need new wrinkles. I had more than enough already. "The Russians are actually cooperating for a change," Burns said. "It seems that they're not denying Andrei Prokopev has Red Mafia connections." "He does. They've been monitoring him for some time themselves. They hope to use him to penetrate the huge black market still coming out of Moscow." I cleared my throat. "But..." Burns nodded. "Right. The Russians tell us, now, that Prokopev is not the man we're looking for. They're certain of it." I felt completely drained. "Because?" It was Burns's turn to shake his head. "They know what the wolf looks like. He was KGB after all. The real wolf set us up to believe he was Prokopev. Andrei Prokopev was one of his rivals in the Red Mafia."
"To be the Russian godfather?"
"To be the godfather, Russian or otherwise." I pursed my lips, took a breath. "Do the Russians know who the wolf really is?" Burns's eyes narrowed. "If they do, they won't tell us. Not yet, anyway. Maybe they're afraid of him, too."
Chapter 116.
Late that night, I sat at the piano on the sun porch with one of Billy Collins's poems running around my head. It was called The Blues. It inspired me so much that I sat at the piano and made up a melody to go with the poem. We had lost to the wolf. It happened a lot in police work, though nobody wanted to admit it. Lives had been saved, though. Elizabeth Connolly and a couple of others had been found. Brendan Connolly was in jail. Andrei Prokopev had been caught. But we seemed to have lost the big one, for now anyway. The wolf was still out there. The Godfather was free to do what he did, and that wasn't good for anybody. The next morning, I arrived early to meet Jamila Hughes's flight into Reagan National. I had the usual butterflies before her plane got in, but mostly, I couldn't wait to see Jam. Nana and the kids had insisted on coming to the airport with me, a little show of support for Jamila and for me, for all of us, actually. The airport was crowded but seemed relatively quiet and peaceful, probably on account of the high ceilings. My family and I stood at an exit from Terminal A, near the security check. I saw Jam, then so did the kids, who started poking me. She was wearing black from head to toe. She looked better than ever, and Jamila always looked good to me.
"She's beautiful and so cool," Janie said, and lightly touched the back of my hand.
You know that, don't you, Daddy?
She is, isn't she? I agree. Looking at Janie now, rather than at Jamila. She's also smart. Except about men, it would seem.
We really like her, Janie continued. Can you tell?
I can. I like her, too.
But do you love her?
Janie asked in her usual no-nonsense, get-to-the-heart-of-the-matter way.
Do you?
I didn't say anything. That part was between Jam and me.
Well, do you?
Nana joined in. I didn't answer Nana either, so she shook her head, rolled her eyes. What do the boys think? I turned to Damon and little Alex. The big boy was clapping his hands and smiling, so I knew where he stood. She's definitely all that, said Damon, and he grinned. He always got a little goofy around Jamila. I moved toward her, and they let me go alone. I snuck a glance back at them, and they were grinning like a Cheshire cat family. I had a lump in my throat. Don't know why. I felt a little spacey, and my knees were weak. Don't know why, either.
I can't believe everybody came, Jamila said as she slid into my arms. That makes me happy. I can't tell you how much, Alex. Wow, I think I'm going to cry. Even though I'm a tough-as-nails homicide detective. You all right? You aren't all right, I can tell.
Oh, I'm fine now. I held her tight. Then I actually picked Jam up, set her back down. We were quiet for a moment.
We're going to fight for little Alex, she said.
Of course, I told her. Then I said something that I'd never told Jamila before, though it had been on the tip of my tongue many times.
I love you, I whispered. I love you too, she said. More than you can imagine. More than even I can imagine.
A single tear ran down Jamila's cheek. I kissed it away. Then I saw the photographer taking pictures of us, the same one who was at the house the day we were evacuated for personal safety, the one hired by Christine's lawyer. Had he gotten Jamila's tear on film?
Chapter 117
They came to the house on Fifth Street. They came about a week after Jamila went back to California. Them again. One of the saddest days of my life. Indescribable. Unthinkable. Christine was there with her lawyer and Alex Jr.'s law guardian and a case manager from Children's Protective Services. The case manager wore a plastic ID around her neck, and it was probably her presence that bothered me the most. My children had been raised with so much love and attention, never with abuse or neglect. There was no need for children's services. Gilda Haranzo had gone to court and been granted a declaration of order giving Christine temporary guardianship of little Alex. She had won custody based on the claim that I was a lightning rod for danger, putting the child in harm's way. The irony of what was happening was so deep that I almost couldn't stand it. I was trying to be the kind of policeman that most people wanted, and this was what I got? A lightning rod for danger? Is that what I was now? And yet, I knew exactly how I had to act this morning on Fifth Street. For little Alex's sake. I would focus on what was best for him. I would be supportive during the handover. If it was possible, I wouldn't let anything frighten the boy or upset him. I even had a long printed list of Alex's likes and dislikes ready for Christine. Unfortunately, Alex wasn't buying any of this. He ran behind my legs and hid from Christine and the lawyer. I reached around and gently stroked his head. He was shaking all over, quivering with rage. Gilda Haranzo said, Maybe you should help Christine take little Alex to the car. Would you please do that? I turned and tenderly wrapped my arms around the big boy. Then Nana, followed by Damon and Janie, knelt beside him for a group hug.
We love you, Alex. We'll visit you, Alex. You'll come see us, Alex. Don't be scared.
Nana handed Alex his favorite book, which was Whistle for Willie. Janny gave him his love-worn plush cow, Moo. Damon hugged his brother and tears started down his cheeks.
I'll be talking to you tonight. You and Moo, I whispered, and kissed my son's darling little face.
I could feel his heart going fast.
Every night. Forever and a day, my sweet boy. Forever and a day.
And little Alex said,
Forever, Daddy.
Then they took my son away.
Epilogue. Wolves.
Pasha Sorokin was due at the courthouse in Miami at 9 o'clock on Monday morning. The van he rode in was escorted from the federal prison by half a dozen cars. The route wasn't known by any of the drivers until the last possible moment before departure. The attack took place at a stoplight just before the cars would have gotten on the Florida Turnpike. They hit with automatic weapons and also rocket launchers, which took out most of the escort cars in under a minute. There were bodies and smoking metal everywhere. The black van that Pasha Sorokin was riding in was quickly surrounded by six men in dark clothes, no masks. The car doors were yanked open, and the police guards were beaten and then shot dead. A tall, powerful-looking man strode up to the open door and peered inside. He smiled playfully, as if a small child were in the prison van.
Pasha, the wolf said. I understand that you were going to turn me in. That's what my sources say, my very good sources, my incredibly well-paid sources. Talk to me about this.
It's not true, said Pasha, who meanwhile was cowering in the middle seat of the van. He wore an orange jumpsuit, and his wrists and ankles were bound by chains. He no longer had his Florida tan.
Maybe, maybe not, said the wolf.
Then he fired one of the rocket launchers point blank at Pasha. He didn't miss.
Zamochit, he said, and laughed. One can't be too careful these days.
This has been a Time Warner Audiobooks production of The Big Bad Wolf, written by James Patterson and read by Peter J. Fernandez and Dennis O'Hare. Executive producer, Maya Thomas. Produced and directed by Kevin Thompson. Production supervised by Dennis Cahill. The Big Bad Wolf is also available in hardcover from Little Brown and Company. Also look for Four Blind Mice, the previous installment of the Alex Cross Detective Series, wherever books are sold. To listen to samples and read more about the authors, please visit Time Warner Audiobooks' website at twbookmark.com. This audiobook is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously, and any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, events or locales, is entirely coincidental.